this is Pearlanne Podcast. I'm now in LA. I am sitting with Daniel McLean. Daniel, can you just give the audience a brief about yourself?
Well, I'm, I guess, an international art attorney based here in LA, practice in LA, practice in London, did two different firms. I'm very lucky because I've been doing this for quite a while, and I act for a lot of different people in the art world, artists, advisors, collectors, dealers, museums, curators, the whole spectrum. So I see the good, the bad, and the ugly.
What I realized when I was reading my brief, that you were working in the art world first.
Yeah, that's right. I never thought I'd be a lawyer. When I was at university, I saw this Solar Witch show, and
I love Solar Witch.
It was like I'd loved art until then, and actually, I'd my first job before then, just in a summer job in London, was at Marlborough Fine Art. My first introduction. So I loved art, and then I just became very interested in contemporary art after that Solar Witch show. So I ended up working at the Henry Moore Foundation. My first thing was to work on a construction of a Gansfeld sphere with James Turrell.
Oh, love it!
It was insane. And so I just was introduced to all these experiences. And I worked with Marianne Goodman, and I also, worked in the art world internationally, ended up working with Fumio Nanjo in Tokyo. And I was curating.
Well, Fumio Nanjo.
Nanjo ran the museum.
Nanjo is a friend.
Nanjo-san, yeah.
Yeah, Nanjo is a friend.
And so I had a great, experience. I went to the Corsold Institute, did a master's there. And, I always say, going into law was a kind of accident. It was when I was, I got introduced to copyright by my friend Carsten Schubert, who's no longer with us, who once said, I want to do this book. Can I have Glenn Brown, my friend, has all these issues with appropriation art and lawsuits and copying other artists' work because a lot of artists don't think about copyright rules.
Yeah.
And so that kind of made me curious, and I ended up doing a book on copyright and art and how they relate to each other, like legal, but also cultural perspectives. And that sort of began the journey into art law, which was when I decided to go to law school and, change.
It's a big change.
It's a big change.
A big step to take a plunge.
Yeah.
And then to go and study law.
Yeah.
Wow.
What a mistake, huh?
but then...
So then I worked with great people. I trained at Michigan de Rey. There's a great art law group there. I worked with Withers and then joined Mark Stevens in London. So I always worked with great art lawyers, and I just was able to develop a practice around it. And I think just, one of the most important things about being an art lawyer is, I say this, a lot of people, it's such a small niche area of law, but you really have to understand the market and the practice.
Absolutely.
And how there's no point doing it otherwise. So, a lot of students say, I want to be an art lawyer. And I said, well, get some experience, work in a gallery, intern in an auction house, understand how.
You have to understand.
Yeah, go and work with you, not with me.
Yeah.
Go and work with
you. You have to understand the protocol and how things work.
Absolutely. And then, so ironically, my experiences really served as a very good foundation for doing what I do. Because I understand it from both perspectives.
So how do you start editing the book, artist or authorship and legacy?
Well, that was like my third book with Carsten.
I did one
on copyright, one on trials, and then
one on trials as well.
But the authorship one was the last one, and that was interesting because really the theme of the book.
I was looking at a summary. I said, how the hell? I said, when I talk to Daniel, when we talk about deals and all that, never knew that he's a writer and an editor.
I've also curated a lot of great shows as well.
But let's talk about
the book is really looking at focusing on issues of authorship and authentication. And it's really looking at how authorship is exercised during not just the lifetime of the artist, but also subsequently by other protagonists like heirs and estate representatives, and even, connoisseurs, for example, or art critics who edit catalog resume or committees. I mean, they have a huge power, as in the art market. If a committee decides that something's not authentic, then that effectively
meaning everything becomes valueless.
Yeah, exactly. And so even third parties can be exercise authorship who have no necessary relationship even with the original artist, you know. I mean, I think Diego Giacometti committee, for example, which was, you know, came out to really deal with a whole controversy with issues of with Diego Giacometti's work, yes. was also, you know, I think it was a police officer for a while who actually ended up running a committee, and you know, for a long time, because he was involved in getting rid of all of these fakes.
And all the fake
so
pieces.
So who would have thought, you know, that an Inspector Clouseau is deciding what is authentic
or not. But how could a police, a police officer has the eye or the experience
to... Well, that's
a
good question. Yeah, I think there were other people who were assisting him, but even so, it's really about how all of this, all of these issues really come down to sort of authority. Who has the authority in the art world to judge? And then how are its decisions followed in practice? And you know, the law is, it can help arbitrate some of the, and resolve some of those disputes from time to time. But really, the art world has its own system. Absolutely. It has its own, you know, governors and custodians, and that's what we all have to navigate.
Recently, the old master market has been reviving.
Yeah.
Now, the old master, we all know, the most difficult is the authentication.
Yeah.
So are you, do you have any clients dealing with the old master?
I deal a lot with old masters.
It's really very, very difficult.
It is. And it's interesting, historically, one of the first cases I worked on was a case involving a Van Dyck painting and its authorship and its sale. And in that case, a painting had been sold by an English gallery, and it had turned out that the experts, after its sale, decided it wasn't authentic. And it, the buyer sued the gallery.
Gallery
Agnews. And in the end, the buyer lost. And the buyer lost because the English legal system has a, particularly for old masters, has this, even if it was described as being attributed to the artist, the attribution wasn't considered to be a binding part of the contract. They caveat emptor, buyer beware.
Really?
So the risk was allocated to the buyer. And that actually is interesting. Historically, that's been a traditional position in English law with authentications, but which is very much tied to the old masters. And the idea that how can anyone really know? Because there's so much residual uncertainty with authentication from a kind of historical perspective. Yeah. So that is really fascinating. But you know, authentication comes in many different guises. It's not always just about authorship. It can also be about dating, or you know, if you look at a recent Damien Hirst scandal, for example, that was really about whether, you know, these works were from his vintage period,
exactly,
from the 90s or not, which would make them more valuable.
This is a way to do it, not to devaluate the work itself.
Exactly.
But the old master is a very, very difficult market because, I mean, authentication has been always big, big problem.
I think there's an interesting development, and I was reading about this in relation to the Caravaggio that was sold recently, where AI has actually given it a determination that of sort of very, very high probability of being a Caravaggio in terms of, now that always poses an interesting question, because authentication is not just about, is not just forensic. There's always this subjectivity, connoisseurship. And so, but I do think that technology, particularly AI, can be of some assistance in there. It can't be definitive, but it can help at least rule out things, which I think almost like negatively, so you can prove a positive through removing negatives.
So do you rely on blockchain then?
I have to confess, I'm a Luddite. My wife goes crazy. I'm not very technologically savvy. I don't deal a lot with blockchain. I know I have a friend in London who's kind of pioneering on blockchain, who runs Verisart, and I think it's important. But I mean, my clients, frankly, do not use blockchain. And I think it's there's been a lot of those sort of utopianism about technology, and that, I think.
But you were just talking about AI.
I know,
right?
Which surprises me. Yeah. I didn't think I would be discussing AI.
If the AI could help to authenticate.
I think AI can help contribute to authentication. And I think blockchain can also be useful in terms of, well, particularly I get when things are digitalized, but also belonging to the, you know, created as of now. I think if you're looking about blockchain going forward retrospectively, dealing with issues of ownership and provenance and things historically, you still have issues. You have to make sure that the data and all the stuff that's put in.
Of course.
But I think, I mean, where the promise, I guess, of blockchain is creating a kind of, you know, sort of lineage, which is transparent from the creator to the, you know, subsequent purchasers, which can't be corrupted. And whether that is in reality, accords with reality is, you know, perhaps open to question, but at least there is, you know, there's a tool there for discussion, you know. I think one of the problems AI doesn't, blockchain doesn't address though, which is part of the theme of the book, going back to artist authorship and legacy, is that essentially artworks are kind of contingent objects.
Of course.
That, you know, that the ownership is contingent, but also authorship is contingent. And even if you own something which, I mean, particularly if it's, even if you own an artwork by a certain artist, it can change over time. It can, condition can change. Artworks which aren't painting may also be, for example, like conceptual artworks, like Solowit. You know, you have a wall drawing. That's a question about how it's iterated each time. So there's an ongoing relationship.
But back, it's ongoing back, changing
between,
as well. But
yeah, it's changing and it's fluid, but there's an ongoing relationship between the artist or the owner and the artist or who exercises authorship. So this makes ownership of art as a kind of so-called asset very, very fluid. And, you know, artworks aren't liquid or fungible in the same way as other assets because, you know, there are always these issues built into them, these contingencies, you know.
So who?
Which makes it interesting.
Who owns the artwork then?
Well, I mean, obviously you'd say the collector, but you know, or the private collector or the purchaser, but there are so many limitations on ownership when you get to think about it that exist in the own artwork, in the art world that...
And even the IP, the IP always remain with the artist, especially
it
today's
do.
World.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you
and
know.
Then moral rights, for example, so that an artist can say, you know, object to how a work is treated by its owner. So there are, that's a constraint. The right at the integrity right. There are things which are limitations of on ownership in a positive way. And then you have also in terms of like with cultural property issues of, you know, cultural heritage, export, all of these restrictions, you know, even if you own something technically in terms of its ownership provenance, it may come from a country of origin which has export regulations, which can then be another, you know, encumbrance, you know. So complex.
So what you're saying is, Daniel, your job is very interesting.
I hope it is. I think it is interesting. Okay. I think I'm lucky. I think my clients
you
are
interested. You know, you're spinning into many different areas.
No, it's also, I mean, I feel very privileged because I, you know, I've got to meet a lot of great people and I have fantastic clients. And the sadness is that a lot of what I do is very, you know, it's discreet, it's confidential.
Of course.
It's, and so I have this sort of, you know, books and books of stories I would like to be able to share, which are kind of privately held.
You don't need to share the name, but just share the content.
I mean, but I guess I also see a lot of things, you know, I'm privy to a lot of things, which, like I said before, the good, the bad, and the ugly, I see, you know, the crazy stuff that goes on in the art business, which we're, you know, and because at all ends, and particularly the high end with the speculation. But I mean, I love working with artists and I do a lot of commissioning agreements. I wrote a book actually on commissioning art, co-wrote with Louisa Buck about 10 years ago. And
what, 10 years ago?
I know. It's a Thames and Hudson book. It's pretty interesting. And it looks at different models of commissioning. And I'm really lucky at the moment because I'm the counsel on the art projects for Powder Mountain or Powder Art Foundation. That's something I can publicly say. And this is an extraordinary project that's being created in Utah. It's on a mountain ski resort.
Whoa.
And it's going to become the Inner Team of America. So there's, you know, there's a whole, in partnership with the Deer Foundation and Reed Hastings from Netflix was the commercial.
Hey, that's
exciting.
It.
Then has created this foundation. Oh, it's absolutely fantastic. And so that's wonderful working on that. I've also worked on, as we will talk about later, Luna, which is fascinating.
Let's wait. I think that's a very exciting project.
So
I will wait for you to enlighten all of us.
Absolutely.
Now, I mean, I think the next thing I would really like to talk to you about is many artists, they are creating foundation, especially, I mean, I know a lot of artists in China, but they have spent their career overseas, they returned to China. They are elderly. They all now is creating a foundation to protect their legacy.
Yeah.
And they want, after they pass away, the artwork will continue to be exhibited to gain values and all that. What do you think about these foundations?
Because broadly, I think it's a very good thing. And obviously,
the thing is, you look at Motherwell, you know? Yeah. Motherwell did have a foundation.
Yeah.
But then, unfortunately, he gave the directorship to a studio manager, which hasn't done a great job.
This is an important point. I mean, one of the key aspects with legacy planning in terms of any structure that's implemented, but it's particularly key for foundations, is who do you appoint to be your custodians? Because the foundations are the custodians of legacy. And so that's one of the critical questions. And if you get that wrong, or if there are conflicts with the estate, like we had with the trustees with the classic Rothko-Marlborough dispute, you have those issues. But I mean, appointing the right custodians is really an essential part of it. I think also having a kind of, there needs to be flexibility in planning, and also a kind of maybe an understanding, not the purpose of the foundation is not to last forever. Like, I think I heard a great talk that Lisa Lefebvre gave, who runs the Holt Smithson Foundation, and she's fantastic. And she was talking about sunset provisions, and you know that this foundation doesn't go on forever. That it reaches a point of to realize legacy. It's not a kind of, there has to be a sunset. It's not just a perpetual. You know, there's often the illusion, but it's not just a perpetual ongoing thing, that it's timed to certain kind of deliverables and I think that's really interesting.
I mean, some of the foundation, they do not sell all the artworks. So some of the artworks, they maintain a quantity of artworks for museum exhibitions and all that. So obviously they should not have a sunset clause then.
Well, if they're well endowed, they are. It depends on. I mean, it depends
on how they set up.
Yeah, it depends on how they're set up. I mean, but in a sense, only a handful of very, very wealthy artist endowed foundations have the kind of resources and means to continue for, you know, a long period of time. And obviously, you have great foundations like the Andy Warhol Foundation that's done extraordinary things for.
But Warhol Foundation is pretty now.
Keith Haring. Yeah. Foundation. I mean, these foundations have really, what I like about them, as well as being able to support the legacy of the artist, they've also expanded the notion of legacy in terms of doing things within the art world generally. And I mean, I'm a beneficiary of that. My first real education in the art world was at the Henry Moore Foundation.
Yes.
And look, I mean, Henry, there weren't many artists who did this, who had the sort of wealth or the foresight to do this in England. England's a relatively poor country compared to the US, but you know, he did it, and he created an extraordinary
legacy, and
the Henry Moore has just also supported so many. It's such an important supporter of exhibitions and institutions, and it has the institution
and support of artists as well.
And that's really very important for the ecology of the art world. So I'm passionate believer in artist foundations, but I think that there need to be these questions asked about custodianship, and also having the means to be able to exist for a viable period of time, you know.
Okay.
I mean, maybe there should be some sort of foundation for foundations where you almost have a collection of foundations. So the individual foundations that are not sufficiently wealthy enough in themselves join forces. I've been discussing this recently with various people in the art world, and I think it's a kind of interesting possibility that it's like a collocation of collection of foundations within a platform, and so they work together almost like in a kind of cooperative way, because individually there are insufficient resources for those individual artist foundations really to function, you know.
Right.
But it's expensive.
I've worked with
a lot of artist estates, and you know, helping manage the relationship between the gallery and the estate, and just the whole custodianship of all of these things are, you know,
promotion, marketing,
and stewardship, storage, insurance, you know,
storage,
intellectual property,
yeah.
All of these things, this huge amount of resources are required, you know.
Now, I just wonder, do you see art work as an investment asset?
I don't personally, but I think I have clients who do. But I think it's a great question. I think it's a very flawed asset if it is an investment asset.
The reason why I'm asking and stating that is that many galleries, including ourselves, we try to protect the artists. I mean, the artwork values.
Yeah.
So we always have a 5 years, 3 years, 5 years non-sale. A non-sale agreement.
Yeah.
When you buy the artwork works, is it? I mean, we have been confronting different occasions, different things. Do you actually think that it is enforceable?
I mean, there's a lot of discussion about this. I mean, I think it's much. What is enforceable is if it's constructed as an option agreement with
I did sue people.
You did?
Yes, and, I did. In Hong Kong, I did.
But there is some consent, there is some movement towards accepting that, even outright restraints on resale, like at public auction for a reasonable period of time, are enforceable. But, historically, the position is that if you sell property, you can't encumber it. So a restraint on alienation through a non-resale prohibition is looked down on by the courts, certainly in England and America. But I think that
Hong Kong is better because we did it in Hong Kong and in China.
But a way around it is to structure it as the gallery has a right of first refusal to purchase the work, or it's reconsigned. And then you're on much safer territory. I mean, that still has to be, that still can't go on in perpetuity. But if you tailor that as a 5-10 year, probably 5 years kind of option, RFO option, you're in a better, you're in a sort of territory where you can enforce that. You know, when artworks were being flipped and you'd have artists coming out.
They flip so high.
And they would go out of school, and then their works would be 150, 200, 300,000. And that kind of stratospheric rise of younger artists seems to be slightly in abeyance right now, I'd say.
Of course, because if you today's market is not exactly a great market. So let's talk about
it's interesting. I worked
a lot. Secondary market deals,
I do a lot of
right?
transactions for clients who are on a secondary level with high blue chip. There's a lot of movement there. I mean, partly... I think,
definitely.
I think it's deals are to be had, and it depends on obviously whether sellers wish to have to sell or need to sell. But if they do, then I think it's a good time to buy, probably because
it is a buyer's market today.
It's a buyer's market,
It's a buyer's market is depending on whether the seller, as you said, is willing to sell, and also whether the buyer now has the opportunity to buy really premium, best work, if they are willing to pay a bit of a premium as well. I mean, as soon as the market is better, too many competitions.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I mean, absolutely. So you do you feel it is the downturn of the market? Do you feel it? Because for us, gallery, definitely, we feel the hit.
I think it depends. The auction data and sales and all the stuff from Sotheby's and Christie's suggest that sales were radically declining. And, you've had those sort of apocalyptic publishing of data about gallery sales from Hauser in London and Sadie Coles and things.
David Swerdbrunner and Hauser.
I think that information, is... Obviously, you have to give that credence in terms of what happens on a secondary private market, which is not reported at a high level.
Vibrant.
It's vibrant. Yeah.
It's vibrant. Yeah. And that's
and
why
the same craziness,
that's
exists.
Why Daniel, you're so busy.
but it's a very interesting world. I mean, you've got, things which are, and it's interesting because I think we were talking about this earlier on it. It's not a fully transparent world. It's a very private world. There are smoke and mirrors. There's hidden principals, hidden buyers, hidden sellers, and, agents, intermediaries. This makes it complex. And one thing I've noticed recently dealing with, the auction houses is with the anti-money laundering requirements.
That gives transparency.
But then they've also created situations where the compliance departments hold that information, but they do a kind of, as it were, Chinese walls where they segregate that information. And I think that's a really interesting kind of technique in a sense, because it's sort of, it's a way of accommodating transparency, but within the art world market, but also still preserving realms of secrecy and confidentiality.
So this is one of the very important things that I would love to hear your opinions, you know, because art world is known to be opaque.
Yes.
Okay. So do you think transparency is needed?
There's a point in which it's not so much, even if it's needed, I just don't think the market as we know it is, the inefficiencies of the market are dealt linked to its opacity, and I don't see that changing fundamentally. And I
With the AML, I think when it first came out, everybody was jumping because you have to release the seller's name, the buyer's name. Yes. Everybody's really reluctant.
Yes.
So everybody comes to Hong Kong.
Yeah.
Because Hong Kong, we don't have AML rules.
Yeah. No. I mean, and that's happened to a degree in the US as well. But I think that AML is becoming more universal. But even when it's becoming universal, there's still ways in which, communication can occur whilst retaining opacity, if you like. So I don't think the art world at some level will fundamentally ever change. And I think if it does, it becomes a very different world. But ultimately, it isn't a market like other markets. It's a unique market.
But my question has always been that, okay, your AML, because of AML, you have to release the seller's name, the buyer's name. But does the auction house ever release the buyer's name or the seller's name? They don't.
Well, they can hold that information in their clients' database. Depending on the, but then they have to get the consent of, if they're selling, for example, in a private.
I mean, a lot of sellers doesn't want people to know that they're selling.
They I think parties can find a way of retaining anonymity.
Of course. Yeah. So actually, it really is defeating what AML is actually trying to. Because they want transparency. I don't think, I agree with you. I don't think that art world is ready for this.
No.
Transparency at all.
No.
Okay, so please tell us your project, your Luna Luna.
Oh, Luna Luna. Luna Luna. Did you ever get to see it? Or?
No.
Well, Luna Luna is a fascinating story. It's an art amusement park, the world's first ever art amusement park that was created in 1987 by a curator, Andre Heller, who was an Austrian artist impresario. And he had this dream of getting all these different artists to make an art amusement park where the artists create the rides, design them, etc.
I would love to go.
And he found the money in the 80s from a German publishing company to commission all of these artists. And he found 33 different artists. And they produced this wonderful works, which were then shown in Hamburg in the summer of 87, briefly. But it included a Ferris wheel by Basquiat.
Ooh.
And Keith Haring did the most incredible work. He painted the carousel, and David Hockney did a labyrinth, and Dali and Sonia Delaney, and all these great artists of the 20th century. It was a very incredibly fun hybrid project, and it was super interesting because it just disappeared. I mean, it was done just before 89 was when the Cold War sort of officially ended in Europe and, well, globally, and the Berlin Wall. And, it was a prominent time just prior to then. And these artworks were never shown again. They went into storage. They were acquired eventually by a U.S. foundation. Andre Heller was forced to sell the works to a U.S. foundation. And then there was a dispute which lasted almost 20 years
over
whether they would buy the work or not. So they tried to cancel. There was a dispute over their sale, and so eventually there was this litigation, and the artworks ended up going from Vienna to Texas in 2007, after literally litigation from early
decades
and decades of litigation. And then it went. The containers were on were in the middle of Texas, nowhere near the Oklahoma border. Owned land owned by this foundation. And I went to see them in 2008 with somebody who was interested in purchasing them. And I then became obsessed with the project and formed a company with Andre Heller to buy them. And then one day, around 2021, one, I think, we were contacted by Dream Crew, that's Drake's production company, and Drake, the rap star, and they said, okay, I want to buy this. We'll create a company with you and we'll go and buy it. So it was like an extraordinary thing because I was there negotiating with their lawyers doing a deal, but the deal terms were extraordinary because they were literally, you buy these containers as is, sight unseen. So we didn't know what condition was. And we, you know, paid millions of dollars, bought everything, and transported the containers from Texas to Los Angeles and downtown LA in a Boyle Heights area, in a giant warehouse. We opened everything up in LA and restored it. It was in fantastic condition. And not only that, there was all this merchandise, original merchandise that was in the containers, like t-shirts and posters. So we kind of lucked out. And then we brought it back to life. Well, we restored a lot of it and then did a big exhibition in downtown LA.
When was that?
That was 2 years ago. And then it went to New York to the Shed. And it was in the Shed. And it was in the Shed last year. It finished just before Freeze last year.
Oh, now? So,
no, November 24 to March 25, something like that.
Now, where is it now?
Now it's in storage still, and we're touring it. We're touring it around the US, and then
it's no longer a fun park. Why can't you make it a fun park?
The rides. Unfortunately, the rides are not interactive anymore. You can't ride on them. But their goal is to create new commissions and add fun stuff to it. So, I mean, what's great about this project, Luna Luna, is it was, you know, what a great way to introduce people to art. This is like art outside of the museum walls, right? It's art for the public. It's fun. It's particularly for children.
It's great.
I mean, that's why it was enchanting.
Accessible
and enchanting. So like, and fun. And so, you know, like Keith Haring loved it because of the whole childhood aspect of it.
This is great.
And so it was it's an incredible, it has so much potential. It's really like a kind of lost treasure. So it was fun doing this. Great fun.
At the time, why did they stop after the showing in Germany, right?
Because it largely rained. It was in Hamburg. And in 87, Andre wanted to tour it around the world. It was slated to go around the world and that fell through. And then he was in negotiations with the city of Vienna to sell it to the city and that fell through. And so he was kind of forced to sell it to this foundation in the US, which is a philanthropic foundation, fantastic foundation. But they didn't really have an expertise in art and they wanted to bring it to San Diego originally. That was their plan. And then it didn't work out. So it, you know, this is having a theme park. It's very complex. It's expensive. There are a lot of moving parts.
Yeah, of course.
And it's a kind of, you know, it's an interesting project. And so it's demanding.
So when you first saw this project,
yeah,
it completely enticed you.
It did. It was one of those things where it was just like, you know, it was so exciting and kind of, it's like a lost treasure. And I saw three or four of the works when I went to Texas in 2018, I think, and it was, you know, that was enough to like see this was really an extraordinary thing.
You got really excited.
I got really excited, and then you know, there's also elements of lore and you know, it's a very hybrid project as well, and there are a lot of different people involved in the project, different partners, and people with it's a very collaborative project, and a lot of people's expertise and know-how from different disciplines. So I'm kind of really into that. I think it's important.
Are you happy now with these two exhibitions when people just saw what you all have done?
Yeah,
bringing it back to life.
It was the reception in New York and LA has been amazing. It's been really, really good, and I think it's you know, I hope it grows, and I hope it goes to Asia.
I would love to see that.
A lot of potential for it, you know. Yeah.
But what is the next plan?
The next phase is to tour the historical works. But ultimately, the real vision is to build a, you know, the point two, the contemporary art of, you know, amusement park of the future.
So
you know, where you have rides by Murakami or whatever.
Exactly.
You imagine?
So,
I mean,
and
imagine
so
a Murakami
are you guys
ride.
Going to commission and getting people to come?
That's the long term plan, yeah, definitely. And it's also interesting. It's weird how I've been able to be part of this and then also in a very different capacity with Powder Mountain, the Powder Mountain project. I mean, these are like two extraordinary projects which have been, you know, I've been lucky enough to be involved with, you know.
Yeah. Sorry, Daniel, you don't seem to be a lawyer. You're more like an entrepreneur.
I'm more like an art, I would say I'm an art enthusiast. I'm an art enthusiast. Or that's what I am. Yeah.
And thank you so much, Daniel. Thank you for joining us.
It's been wonderful. Thank you. Great pleasure.
Thank you. Pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.